What did I say? In Israel, it's a rite of passage to kindergarten. You don't graduate kindergarten unless you can recite Tu Bishvati Gia Chagla. But if we lived in a world in which Beit Shammai, the halach was like Beit Shammai, the song would be Aleph Shvati Gia, and this whole shiur will be based around trying to explain why Beit Shammai holds the Tu Bishvat is on Aleph Shvat. Of course, Tu Bishvat can't be an Aleph Shvat because it wouldn't be called Tu Bishvat. It would be called one Bishvat. No, but I know. But if we look in the sheet on page 2, source 18, not really source 18, but this is a Mishnah in Rosh Hashanah. Bechad Bishvat Rosh Hashanah La'ilan Kedivrei Beit Shammai Bet Hillel Amrim B'Chamishah Asar Bo. So this is Tu Bishvat according to Beis Hillel. And Beit Shammai hold that it's Aleph Shvat, and we're going to try to see if there's any depth to that machlokes, or is it really just something very technical? Right? Tu Bishvat has Doraisa Nafkaminas. We know Tu Bishvat in its modern version, which is just it's a day when we eat lots of fruit and we celebrate the fruit of Eretz Yisrael. It's not what it's about at all on the halachic point of view. It's a much later Gilgul in the Hasidic world. It's known as Rosh Hashanah for Chidushei Torah, that all the future Chidushei Torah you have are given to you on Tu Bishvat in the form of fruit. And really, Tu Bishvat is a Doraisa concept. It's relevant mainly to Orla, that you can count it as the third year after Tu Bishvat, and it's relevant to Trumos and Maestros, which you give Maestros. But what's the Machlokes about? Really, we're going to backtrack, and we're going to try to talk about what Beit Shammai are all about, or why so serious? Why Beit Shammai so serious, and really, what's Beit Shammai Beis Hillel all about? Now, we know that Beit Shammai Beis Hillel are kind of the iconic Machlokes. Eizu Machlokes, Hileshem Shemaim, Beit Shammai Beis Hillel. I don't know if they argued on more things than Abayi and Rava, but they're still considered, maybe because they were the earlier ones, Mishnah and Chagiga says that when the Zugos argued, we have like the pre-Tanaim Zugos, of which Shammai and Hillel were the last two, and the Mishnah Chagiga said that they had the first machlokes in Israel. First machlokes. They argued if on Yontav you do smicha, when you press down the head of the korban, or not. All five Zugos argued about the same thing, and it's been timed back to the time of Hanukkah, where there was the first decree against Talmud Torah, which could logically lead to the first unresolved machlokes, because the Masorah might have been lost. The other reasons to believe why those machlokes were more significant, one very nice idea is that there's a rule that the Av Beis Din and the Nasi can overrule the majority opinion. So if there's a Sanhedrin that are arguing and the majority says X, if the Av Beis Din argues, then he can say Y and have to go back again and argue again. In all of the Zugos, the Mishnah ends by saying that one was the Nasi and one was the Av Beis Din, which means that you can never rule against either of them. So, for whatever reason it is, that was considered the first and most iconic machlokes, and Beit Shammai Beis Hillel really represent in our eyes, I mean, Korach represents bad machlokes, which is why the Shir Shel Yom on Monday is a Korach, because Monday is the first time that unity is split. Ooh, deep. But, that's a maral. The question is this. Beit Shammai Beis Hillel argue on a lot of things. Every source on the sheet, almost every source, is a machlokes Beit Shammai and Beis Hillel. And this isn't all of them. There are tens, if not more than that, if not hundreds. Well, 100 or more. And the question is, can we say that all, most, some of these machlokeses stem from some one core machlokes, something slightly more philosophical or ashkafic or psychological that may have led to, not all, it's a bit, you know, presumptuous to say that everything they ever said stems from one idea, but can we suggest or say that a lot of the machlokeses in halacha really stem from some deeper underlying philosophy of life? And if we can say that, then what is it? Now first we have to ask, what right do we have to suggest that? You see two people arguing on 70 things. Should you assume that they happen to have 70 different disagreements? Or should I be inclined to say they probably have one underlying core root to the arguments? So there seem to be six reasons, five and a half reason. There seem to be 5.5 reasons why we should assume, and why many achronim assumed, that Beit Shammai Beis Hillel is not just a lot of machlokas is independent, rather they stem from one root argument. What are the reasons to assume that? So number one, maybe the strongest idea, is Beis Shammai, Beis Hillel. We do not find anywhere else in Tanaim and Amoraim that there's a Beis X and a Beis Y. Even though Rav and Shmuel, each one was a Rosh Yeshiva, we don't find Beis Rav and Beis Shmuel. We don't find any of the Amoraim or Tanaim, even those who seem to have a Mahalach. When Abai and Rava argue, it's quite often that Rava is slightly more nitpicky about the wording of the Mishnah. Whereas Abaye is less concerned, but we don't find Beis Rava and Beis Abaye. The moment you find Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, right? Shammai and Hillel themselves, by the way, it's quite intriguing. We only have documented in Shas three halachic disagreements between Shammai and Hillel. It's interesting, only three, and the rest of the disagreements seem to be in Midos and in Machshava, as we'll see. So they only argued, as far as we know, well, we only have recorded three. But Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel argue on many, many things. So the fact that they are a school of thought, the house of Shammai and house of Hillel, seems to imply that there's a mahalach, right? They belong, you choose to belong to a certain school of thought, or you naturally belong there based on your inclinations, and that makes you a member of that approach. And many of your halachas are consistently based on that philosophy. So the base, Shammai Beis Hillel, already implies that it's a base, not just stam. The second thing, which is maybe a bit softer, is that as we'll see, Shammai and Hillel themselves, and Beis Shammai Beis Hillel, uncharacteristically, I think, for Tanaim and Amoraim, they argue a lot about Hashkafa, Machshava, and Midos. So it seems like a bit of a coincidence to say that they have a lot of machlokuses in Halacha, and they also have machlokuses in Midos and Machshava and Hashkafa and philosophy, and they have nothing to do with each other. You know, it's likely that if two people have consistently disagreements about certain topics that are philosophical, and they also have halachic ones, could be coincidence, but it's more likely that there's something systematic about their way of thinking. So that's the second. Again, these aren't proofs. These are reasons to suspect that there's something more going on than just, you know, Beis Shammai thinks Aleph Shvat, Beis Hillel thinks Tu B'Shvat, for technical reasons. Might be something deeper on the line. The third thing, which is a tricky question, because we find this in contemporary Poskim too, we know that Beis Shammai are almost always the Machmer approach. Now, it's not exclusively true. The Mishnah in Arios, which we have here in source... Oh man, I should have memorized the sources. Somewhere on this page, there is a Mishnah in Arios.
12?
Yes, exactly. No. That's also Mishnah Arios. Arios is very much a miscellaneous masechta. It's by definition just all of the statements that were said when Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah became the Nasi, so there's no theme to it. But it starts Elu, Mikulei, Bechamai, Mikumrei. Is that who?
Session Dalet.
Oh, yes. Okay, shkoyach to me. So, section Dalet regarding Chumras and Gezeros. So, the Mishnah Arios has a list of all the cases in which Beis Shammai are Mekel. Now, there happen to be quite a few. There are 30 things there. But still, you only write a list. These are the things that Beis Shammai are Mekel, as in to say, whoa, Beis Shammai are Mekel. So, what would lead a school of thought to consistently be the more Machmer opinion? I'm not talking about a psychological factor like being afraid of being Mekel, but there seems to be something underlying. If a posek is some poskim just seem to be always on the Machmer approach, maybe they're just more concerned, more. But the fact that they are consistently the Machmer approach and they make many gezeros, that's like Chumras and gezeros, a vast majority, a large number of the Chumras of Beit Shammai are gezeros. So Beis Hillel say that you can... No example. We'll see the examples. So what would lead Beis Shammai to put into place multiple gezeros and chumras, whereas Beis Hillel seem to be consistently mekel? Where does that come from? That's a third sign of something being systematic. The fourth thing is well worth myth-busting, but we all know that what's going to happen in the Mosa Mashiach... Nothing, most likely. But we have this tradition, this myth that the halacha will change to be like Beis Shammai. It is found nowhere in Chazal or in Rishonim or in any halachic source. But everyone quotes it. If you try to find the source by Googling, you'll find that every source that says, it is known that in Yimos HaMashiach. Yeah, it is, because you copied it from someone else who said that it's known. So basically, it is not known, and it's against everything we believe in, the halacha will change, but it's known that the halacha will change to be a bit... Now, how can the halacha change to be like Beit Shammai? Wouldn't we have to examine each machlokas and say what we think? The fact that we can flip, even within the myth, because even if the myth isn't true, even if halacha won't change, but the fact that there's this idea that some claim, and no one came and argued at it by saying, well, that doesn't make any sense, how can you take all of the machlokas and flip them? what we may have a problem with is who says you can change halach in the future. But the fact that the idea itself is about flipping all, that shows that it's about the approach, not about the details. It wouldn't make sense to say that they happen to, by coincidence, argue on 100 topics and they're each independent, and it happens to be that from all of the machlokuses in Am Yisrael, these 100 independent machlokuses, we're going to change the... That must be a system. Only when there's a system that underlies... And this would imply that all of the halachas that they say are systematic. Not taking it very far. It's almost as though they never said any halacha that was independent from their life approach. But either way, the flipping of Bichami to Mosa Mashiach seems to imply very strongly that it's a system, not independent rules. Number five, this is a bit more fine. This, I'm not sure if anyone else says this except for me, but fine. But number five, we all know the famous Gemara about Elu Ve'elu Divrei Pilchei, multiple truths, where Bichami is saying this, and Bishilla is saying this, and Bichami say that the halacha is like us, and Bishilla say the halacha is like us, and then the Baskol says halacha like Bishilla. What does it mean that they argue about a certain halacha, and then each opinion says that the halacha is like them? Isn't that what it means to argue on a halacha? Imagine that, you know, Shlomo Zalman and Rav Moshe are arguing if you can make tea on Shabbos in a Kli Shlishi, and then they say, in addition to what I hold, I also hold that the halach is like me. As in to say that when a regular posek has an opinion, what he means is, I don't care. So, what does it mean that we argue about A, B, C, D, and I also hold, what it seems to imply to me, is what they're saying is these are details upon which we argue, but there's an underlying theme, and I believe that my approach to life is right and yours is wrong. And therefore, not only do I hold A, B, and C, I hold that my A, B, and C are authoritative and yours aren't. And then the Baskol says, halacha like Beis Hillel, on which machlokes? On all of them. What kind of Baskol comes and says, Beis Hillel happened to argue on Beis Shammai on 300 independent topics that are not connected to each other, and it happens to be, by way of tremendous coincidence, that we like Beis Hillel. That's not such a good proof, because Beis Hillel were the majority, Beis Shammai were the minority, and all the Baskol did, it said, follow the regular rules. But still, there might be something there. So those are the five reasons that we suspect that there's something more happening in. Now, the sixth reason, I call it a bit of a half a reason, because it's not a reason. It's a kind of a retrospective reason, which is once I say the idea and show the examples, you'll say, oh yeah, that makes sense, and that's a proof. Meaning to say that this is the test result, meaning once you say what the underlying system is and you give enough examples, these are, again, there are many examples there, and these aren't all of them, but it seems to be true. Now, several different... You know, rabbis in the previous generation and a bit before have suggested different ways of saying what the underlying machlokas is. And they're really all saying the same thing. It's just that the ones who are more Kabbalistically oriented said it in Kabbalistic terms, using, you know, din and rachamim. And the ones that were more philosophical, so they use different terms to describe what they think the underlying theme is. The one I'm going to use is Rav Zevin. Rav Zevin was a fantastic... rabbi in the previous generation. He was the first editor of the Talmudic Encyclopedia and a bunch of other amazing things. And he has a very famous piece called Leshitat Bet Shammai Vebet Hillel. It's the subtitle that I gave. And he uses, I think, very nice, clear terms in a way that it really explains more machlokuses than anyone else did. And also it has a bit more of a life lesson to it. And the terms he used is Bekoach and Befaal. And Bekoach meaning in potential, like Koach, you have the power to do something, something which has not happened yet. It's not the world the way we know it, but it's the world in the way that it could be if we only act right. Whereas Basilel saw the world in a much more Befaal way, in actuality. And that's very abstract. But once we talk about it in details, it will make more sense. Maybe to get a sense of it, we'll start with Shammai and Hillel themselves. Now, as I said, they argue, well, we have documented very few of their arguments, and they are mainly non-halachic, but they are still good indicators of the type of people that Shammai and Hillel were. And the claim is that the type of people they were, now I don't know if to say what's the egg and what's the chicken, because it's always tricky, meaning did they have a certain psychological inclination and that led them to, I don't know, but either way, let's see. So if you look in section Bet, number 1, page 1, section Bet, number 1. The numbers aren't the numbers of the sources, they're the numbers of the examples. Well, it makes very little difference except for the 13 and 14 are together. So This is a very famous Gemara in Masechet Shabbos, a couple of stories there about Shammai and Hillel, but one of them, it just says it straight out. That in terms of personality traits, it says, Tana Rabbanan, Lolam Yehe Adam Anvitan Ke Hillel Ve'al Yehe Kapdan Ke Shammai, that we're instructing for the masses that a person should be humble, easygoing, and tolerant like Hillel, and not be a Kapdan, someone who's very makbid, a Kanai, has little patience and demands high standards from people like Shammai. And then it brings a story that I'm not going to read the whole story. I cut down the story. It's an interesting story about two people that made a bet. And they said, let's see which one of us can make Hillel angry and lose his temper. And he'll get 400 zuz. 400 zuz is a lot. It's twice a ksuva. It's 2 years worth of food. It's a lot of money. So whoever manages to... So they knew this was a challenge. Whoever manages to anger Hillel will win 400 zuz. I cut it down, so one of them said, I'll do it. I'll rise to the channel of, you know, having really bad midos and disrespecting God Lador. And then dot, he asked him a whole list of very strange questions. Not even half the questions, very bizarre questions. And Hillel was very patient, and Hillel said to me, ask whatever questions you want, it's fine. It was Friday, people are stressed out, and Hillel was just, yeah, please, I'll answer these weird biology questions. And then, after he saw that asking the questions didn't work that well to anger him, so the guy said, are you Hillel, that you're the Nasi? And he said, yes. And he said, if you're Hillel the Nasi, I give a blessing that there will not be any more people like you in Am Yisrael. And he said, why? Because you cost me 400 zuz. And Hillel said to him that you should be careful, because, you know, Hillel is Kedai that you should lose. It's better that you should lose all the money in the world than I should be angry. So this is really Anvitan. He was humble and tolerant, whereas Shammai was much more makbid and demanded high standards of people. So that starts on a basic psychological level. And where does it spill over to? So if you look in Aleph 3, I'm going out of order for reasons that I'm not so sure about. But in Aleph 3, a very famous story, and you can see that it's really just the manifestation of their personalities leading on to a slightly hashkafic, or even I would say halachic level. In source 3, we have a particularly famous story about a non-Jew that came to Hillel and Shammai to convert, and he said to Shammai, convert me on the condition that you teach me the whole Torah while I'm standing on one foot. Right? So it sounds like literally, not like we have the term al regel achas in modern Hebrew, which means briefly. But it sounds like... Yeah, of course. A lot of modern Hebrew phrases are Talmudically based and people don't even realize. Very nice ones. So, but here he literally, according to Agirsa, he's saying, teach it to me while I'm on one foot, which could be a long time. But either way, Shammai said to him, he didn't say anything, right? He pushed him with a yardstick. This Gemara led people to believe that Shammai was it's funny because he was what we call today a Shammai, which I don't think is connected. It's from the word Shuma. He was someone who assesses the value of property. That's the word Shammai, because Lashu means to evaluate. So Shammai was a Shammai. If you want to get really fancy, I'll explain why that might be connected to his philosophy, but that's probably made up. But he pushed him with the yardstick. So basically the answer is no, get out. What do you mean, convert you, on the condition that I teach you all of Torah in brief? Either you convert fully after learning all of the Torah or what you need, or you don't convert. High standards. Either you're a proper Jew and you're committed, or don't bother. There's no such thing as minimal beginners, right? This is the beginner's conversion version, right? No, you convert properly or not at all. Came to Hillel, he converted him. And he said, what's the whole Torah? And this is the source of the concept which later spread to so many different religions and philosophers, which is, don't do upon others what you don't want to be done to you. I have a great chart at home from a book called The Science of Good and Evil, where he charts out the... all the historical appearances of this phrase in different versions, and the oldest one documented is this Gemara. So it's very nice. It's filled up. Who? It's by Michael Shermer. It's a bad book. No, really. It's a boring book. It sounds amazing, but it's not a good book. But it has this chart in it. I'm not saying it's not a good book. I'm saying that I didn't like it. And I'm just saying, some books you read and like, oh, I have to recommend this, and here you have to like decommend this. Now, so it's very clear that this different approach to converting people, which should also be an approach to teaching people, right? Which I may talk about how you only teach someone if he's, you know, ooh, wow. And he'll say, teach everyone. So it's about the tolerance you have towards people's limitations. We don't live in a perfect world. We live in a far from perfect world, and we're far from perfect beings. And that's okay. And we have to start with baby steps. And if you want to convert on the condition that you just understand the basics of religion now, but you plan on walking slowly towards being a good person, I'll give you the chance. Whereas Bachama is saying, no, I'm very marked. You either full-fledged Jew with all the knowledge, or don't bother, come to me when you're already holding there. I want you to now be where your ideals lie. That's the idea of the potential should be actualized right now. And if we go to a purely halachic example in Gimel 4, right? Yes. Gimel 4, this is also quite famous. This is another, I'm starting with these because these are the Shammai and Hillel themselves, the fathers. Some claim that they established the batin themselves, but I don't know if that's made up or not. So here we have the famous halacha about Kovach Shabbos, that they said that Shammai Hazaken, every day of the week, he would eat Lekovach Shabbos. Well, it really means that he would shop Lekovach Shabbos, meaning from Sunday he found a nice piece of meat, he would buy it and say, this is for Shabbos. And then if on Monday he found a better piece of meat, he would eat Sunday's meat and say, this is for Shabbos. Everything he bought was immediately for Shabbos, because the whole week is a build-up. The potential of the days is to lead up to Shabbos. So your shopping should always be Lichvot Shabbos Kodesh. If you find something better, that will be. So the preparations for Shabbos start on Motzei Shabbos of the previous week, known as Sunday. So you start working, you see the Shabbos, and you honor it and shop towards it already in step one. Whereas Hillel, Midah Acheret Haitabo. Not a different halachic approach, a different midah. He had a different personality trait or approach to halacha that was manifested in Kol Ma'asav L'Shem Shamayim, meaning Baruch Hashem Yom Yom. Every day, live for today. Yes, I know it's Shabbos. I'll do my Shabbos shopping on Friday. On Friday, I'll do my Shabbos shopping, but today I'm doing my Sunday shopping. Meaning, I live in the here and now, and it's okay. Shabbos may be the peak of the week, but the climb itself is also valuable. And you can focus on your everyday pleasures and enjoyments without that contradicting with the fact that your whole life is really a build-up to the theological declarations of Shabbos. So those are the Shammai and Hillel ones, except for the one that I didn't say yet, which is Bet 2. This is a great system I got myself here. Bet 2 is a Mishnah in Avos, where we have a list of things that Hillel said. Now, some of them may not connect to this idea. I think people are allowed to speak sometimes outside of their philosophy. But Hillel said, "Al tifrosh min hatzibur," right? Don't separate yourself from people. Now, people, clearly, the masses are really all holding where we want them to hold. And therefore, one would think that if you have high standards, goodbye masses. Like, right? The Rambam going to the cave and hiding when people are crazy. So, no, you stay with the people. You are tolerant and accept their limits and you work with them. That works. "Al tamin bi'atzmecha ad yom motcha." Negotiable. Al tadin et chavrecha ad shetagelim komo. Right, and even then, don't do it. Most likely, but don't judge people until you experience their difficulties and challenges. Again, judging people favorably is based on the understanding that people are weak and people have limits and challenges, and it's okay. You don't need to hold them to your standards. And then al tomar davar sheifshar lishmoa, meaning don't teach something or instruct something that the people are not capable of living up to, because it's counterproductive. They'll just fail. So these all seem to fit into the Hillelic. Anyway, the what? Again, I don't want to go into the halachic side of tochecha, but the Gemara does say this. The Gemara does say the halacha that you don't give tochecha when it's clear that tochecha won't be received, because then rather they should be shogeg than mezid. But then it depends on the tochecha shir that I'm not giving now. Yes. Anyway, so those are some Hillel and Shammai machlokuses that already seem to establish, without many details, this idea that they have these two life philosophies. Now we'll go to base and base. Base Shammai, base Hillel, let's see how they adopted these life approaches. Let's start with the non-halachic stuff. So let's go in order. Here's a weird one. Seems to be a very strange machlokes, right? In source Aleph 1, Beit Shammai Omrim, submission Chagiga. No, it isn't. It's a Gemara Chagiga. Beit Shammai Omrim, Shammai Nivru Tchila, Ve'achakach Nivret Ha'aretz, Ubeit Hillel Omrim, Aretz Nivret Tchila, Ve'achakach Shammai. This is a historical machlokes about the order of creation. Were the heavens created first, or the earth? I don't even know what that means. I don't know what creation means, or heavens and earth. Whatever it means, though, we all can understand intuitively that the heaven is more heavenly and the earth is more earthly, for the reasons of simple thing that we live in on earth, and earth is matter, and you know, the superior spiritual beings, whatever they are, whatever that means, live in the heavens. So the heavens clearly represents the higher form of being, the supernatural, that which is not physical, that which has no needs and desires and its horror and limits and problems. And the question is, what's the order? Is the world heaven and earth? Which means that really the ideal towards which we should be striving, the goal, is heavens. Or is it okay to work up from the earth to the heaven? Because God created a world in which we are have a very disadvantageous starting point, and we're pretty nebuch. But the goal is to slowly and surely, and maybe permanently and continuously, climb up. That seems to be a very legitimate interpretation of that machlokes. Here's a weird one, a very strange one. And also weird. It's a sad one. Source 2 in Eruvin. Tanu Rabbanan. Shtei shanim v'mechza. For 2.5 years. Nechlaku beit shamay v'beit hillel. Halal omrim noach l'adam shelo nivra. Yoter shenivra. Right? Fun. V'shamay said that it would have been better for mankind to not have been created. So basically, our lives are b'dieved. The lekatchila would have been not to exist. V'halal omrim, and Beis Hillel say, Noach lo l'adam shenivra, yoter mishlo nivra. So this seems beautiful, right? First of all, it says they argued about this for 2.5 years. One would assume that they also did other stuff, but it seems like a long time to maintain a machlokes. But this would seem classic. Beis Shammai is saying that your life is so far from being perfect that you probably would have been better off not being born. All of us, because we are so deep in the muck of challenges, spiritual challenges, that it's so far from the ideal. Better that you would have been never born, whatever that means, angelic or just non-existent. Life is so far from the ideal that it's not a good idea. And Beis Hillel say, no, it's so much better to be here with all the challenges. That is life. That is God's will. He wants you to have these challenges. The sad thing is that Beis Hillel then changed their mind and admit to Beis Shammai. That's sad. Nimnu v'gamru, they shook hands and agreed, Noch adam shelo nivra, yoter mishenivra. So that's a bit of a tricky one. So, l'kula alma, we were better off not being born. A lovely and uplifting thought to end the year with. Now, but again, the Gemara says, so now that I've been born, what should I do? So it says you should check your actions and see what you're doing right and what you're doing wrong. So still you can say, that's a tough one to deal with. Let's ignore it. We did 3. Source 4, I referenced before, the question of what should be approached towards teaching students. So, Vehamidu Talmidim Harbeh, this is from a sefer called Avos to Rabbi Natan. There's a different version of Avos called Rabbi Natan's Avos. It's printed at the back of the Gemara. And it's not parallel, but it's a similar idea that it's all sorts of Divrei Musar and Chochmah from the Tanaim. And in it, he says that Beit Shammai omrim al yishne adam ela lemishu chacham ve'anav uben avot ve'ashir. The ashir part is interesting, meaning Beit Shammai holds you should only teach someone who's wise and humble enough to accept whatever they say without arguing, maybe. And ben avos is the son of fathers. Okay, whatever, I'm assuming it means fathers with yichus. Ve'ashir and wealthy. I'm not sure what the wealthy part is doing here, but the Beis Shammai have a very selective, very high level filtering system of letting people in. You're in if you're, you know, ready to rise to the top. No mediocre students who won't actualize the ideal of being a Torah scholar. And Beis Hillel omrim l'chol adam yishne. Teach everyone. Again, he says teach everyone because even some people that are not necessarily holding, they could become, but teaching everyone clearly shows that we are not viewing Torah as something for the elite and something that should only be learned by people that can live up to the potential of Torah, but even people that just learn and it's okay. So yes, we have many seminaries yeshivas. We have many yeshivas thanks to, even Beis Shammai would teach in a seminary, wouldn't they? No? Anyway, I don't know, in this seminary. Oh. So, Source 5, that's a great one. We all know the song, Ketzad Merakdim Bifnei Akala. But if we lived in a Beit Shammai world, the song would be very weird. It would say, yeah, whatever, you know, she's not that pretty. That's what the song would be, right? Our song is Kalana Ava Chasuda, graceful and beautiful. Beit Shammai would say, I'll describe it the way it is. Anyway, so it would have been slightly awkward, but we don't compromise. Truth is truth. There's no room for bending the truth or actually full on lying just to please people. If people will be offended by the truth, they should deal with it. As we say, facts don't care about your feelings. Anyway, Beit Shammai. Anyway, Tan Rabbanan, Ketzad Meragdim Lifnei Akala, Beit Shammai Omrim, Kala Kmot Shehi, say it the way it is. So there's a machlokas to say the way it is means, but yeah. So Beit Hillel Omrim Kalan Ava Chasuda. Beautiful. So Beit Shammai say, even if she's, and then it lists a bunch of things that today we would and should be embarrassed to view as things that are not worthy of being phrased as beautiful, but different standards, different, PC wasn't always what it was. So Chigeret, someone who has can't walk, or Suma, blind, so even if she, still we say that she's beautiful, again, not going into that. Not for now, or forever, or for me. But Basilis and Bishama say, but it says, Midvasheka Tirchak, distance yourself from lying. So how can you lie? And Basilis say, what? You're going to offend people? You're allowed to lie in order to not offend people. And Bishama say, no, you don't ever lie. Truth is the ideal of relaying facts the way they were without considering people's emotions. And the question is, do I lower my standard of truth or even totally destroy it and cancel it to please people because I'm a man of the people? Or do I say people's emotions, people should live up to the knowledge, the fact that they are not all they think they are? So that's sort of machshava hashkafa on how to treat people. And now let's start doing the halachos. The halachos is where it gets very creative and interesting. I mean, what we're claiming is the following. It's going to be a bit tricky. What we're claiming is that many of Beit Shammai Beis Hillel's machlokas stem from this philosophical question of, should we hold people to the ideal standard now already? Or should we be accepting of human limitations and say that we deal with things the way they are? Or even on a more abstract level, we'll see, do we view the is now based on what it has the power to do in the future? Some of them are much more obvious than others, and we're not going to do all of them. What happened is Rav Zevin, in his article, he did about 7 of them. Then I said, let's just look up Shammai and Hillel in Bar Ilan and do them all. So a lot of these are just my speculations, and from now on, every time you see Hillel and Shammai, you'll probably be thinking, does it connect or not? Sometimes the connection is a little bit krechtzy. Well, some of these are some of these. So let's start with Gimel number 1, right? So this is a bit of some of these require a bit of background. Gimel number 1 is talking about a case where a woman is suspected of being a sota, then the husband dies before she manages to drink the sota water. So he dies while it is still undetermined if she was a sota or not. And one of the nafkaminas is, does she get to collect her ksuva money, right? Because if she was a sota, which she'll never find out now, we won't, well, she'll find out, she probably knows, she and at least one person, okay, this is, anyway. Stop saying it. We will never find out, Beis Din will never find out, Beis Din will never find out if she's a sota or not. She's what we call a suffix sota. It's interesting. We usually call the woman that goes to drink a sota. She's a suffix sota. Sota is if we have determined that she will have an affair. So she's a suffix sota forever now. So does she collect the ksuva? She comes to Beis Din. She says, my husband died. Give me my ksuva. And they say, but maybe you're a sota. We don't know. So does she collect the ksuva when there's a suffix if she deserves it or not? So there's a machlokes in the Gemara in sota. Metu ba'alehem ad shelo shatu. The husband died before the suffix sota drank the water. So she's always going to be a suffix sota. Beit Shammai v'chulei say that she collects the ksuva. And Beis Hillel say that she doesn't collect the ksuva. So let's ignore chumran kula because that's not relevant. Also, you can't talk about chumran kula and money because chumran to one side is by definition a kula to the other side. So, the Micah Miflegei, what is the root of the argument if the suffix sota should collect the ksuva or not? Beit Shammai savri shtaro medli gavot kegavui dami. Beit Hillel savri shtaro medli gavot lav kegavui dami. Meaning, you have a shtar, it's called a ksuva, and the shtar has the power to collect money. It is the legal document that is used to collect money when the time comes. So who's holding the money? Meaning, the rule is that when there's a suffix, who owes money? So the money stays where it is. So if you come to me and you say that, that my bag is your bag, you need to prove it. And even if if there's two witnesses against and for it, and it's 50-50, the money stays where it is. So where's the money? Well, the physical money is in the husband's possession. His children inherited it. But the paperwork that has the power to extract the money is in the wife's possession. So who holds the money? So Basil says the husband holds the money. Look, the coins are in the husband's pocket or bank account or the children's. But Bishamai say the thing that has the power and potential to produce the money is in the wife's possession. So who has the money? It depends. If you go by the here and now, the husband has the money. If you go by the powers to be and what it can be achieved, then the wife has the money. That's a very halachic and technical manifestation of this idea. Two is even wackier. Because in two, it's a Gemara and Gittin, a Mishnah and Gittin, we know that a Grusha, a divorcee, is not allowed to marry a Kohen. Now, if I asked you at which point you become divorced, I think most of us would say you become divorced at the point where you become divorced. But no, Bisham, I say that the moment the husband writes again, his intention to... It's my wife. No, I'm saying the recording. Is my wife. Anyway. No, I'm joking. She's a DJ in a spare time. Anyway. So, we'll use the 3-time rule. Anyway. Which is if I make that joke 3 times, I have to stop. So, in Source 2, we see the almost unbelievable of a Chamai ride at the moment... She's pretty awesome. Okay. As we were. So, Beishamai say in Source 2, the unbelievable, that the moment a husband writes a get with intention to give it to his wife, she's of course not allowed to marry other people, but the chumra of never being allowed to marry a Kohen already kicks in. So if a husband writes a get to his wife and then dies, so she's really a widow, she can't marry Cohen. Because since the get is a document that has the power to activate and to effect a divorce, there is an element of divorceness already taken place. It's really futuristic. The thing that can bring about being a grusha has in it already the halachic ability to generate that status. And Basila say, well, you didn't give it. So she is not a grusha. So again, it's a very simple idea, and it's also within shtar. I made a list of the ones that I wanted to prove because a lot of them are... number 3 is really important. In Hilchos Shabbos, we know this, if you learned about trapping or bishul or anything, then there is a general machlokas b'shamay b'silel about starting in melacha on Friday that will continue on Shabbos. So putting in clothes in dye before Shabbos, putting olives in the olive press, putting out a trap before Shabbos, anything you do, any action you do on Friday that will cause a melacha to take place on Shabbos, b'shamay say no. Now, Hilchos Shabbos should apply only on Shabbos, which is why perhaps they're called Hilchos Shabbos. And they're not Hilchos Friday. But Beit Shammai seem to extend. Has it been 36 minutes?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, I talk a lot. Beit Shammai extend Hilchos Shabbos to Friday by saying that an action you do now that has the potential power in it and will lead to a melacha on Shabbos is Chilul Shabbos. That's not the Oraisa, because Midoraisa Friday is Friday. But Midirabanan, it's a gezerah they make, that which has the potential to lead to Chilul Shabbos should be viewed on some level as a form of Chilul Shabbos. And Basil say, no, Friday is Friday, Shabbos is Shabbos. So it's interesting. It's the other side of the coin. Beishamai holds that every day of the week has covered Shabbos in it. So on Sunday, you should be shopping for Shabbos, because Shabbos extends to the days that lead up to it. And on the same, by the same token, already on Sunday, well, not really, the days that lead up to Shabbos have the power to perform halachos on Shabbos, and therefore, don't do that. Now we're going to skip to number 5.
Is that Source 3?
That was Source 3, yes. I mean, it's, yeah. You know what? We'll zoom a bit. Should we zoom a bit? Let's zoom a bit. Let's zoom to Source 5. So, in Source 5, we have a Mishnah in Bava Metzia about what happens if someone deposits something by me. I'm a shomer. Someone gives me something to take care of. So the rule is that if I use it, let's say that you give me a tractor. Let's say you deposit your tractor in my possession, a toy tractor. You deposit a toy tractor in my possession, and I have to guard it for you. Right? So if it breaks in a way that is not in my control, it's struck by lightning, or there's a random fire in the house, so then I don't need to pay you back. But if I've used it without permission, so while I'm guarding your tractor, I go vroom vroom, and I play with it, so then if something happens to it, I have to pay. Because the moment I embezzle, it's called sholech yad b'pikadon, you know, extend your hand and use the thing, then I become responsible for what happens to it later. Fine, you weren't supposed to touch it. If you touched it, boom, you're already now fully responsible for it no matter what happens. What happens if I plan on embezzling and using it, and then I change my mind. So logic dictates that evil thoughts don't count for much. But Bishamai say no, the moment you think that you're going to do it, even if you don't end up doing it, it's considered already in your possession that
and
you've done it.
Fire, and then
yes,
then
meaning
it counts as you did it?
No, meaning the point is that the moment you used it without permission, you now assume full responsibility even for things that you wouldn't have been responsible for before. Because it's as if you already stole it and now it's yours. Once it's yours, I owe you the replacement of it regardless of what happened to mine. So it's like if you steal something and then it gets destroyed, even if it's circumstances beyond the control, you still owe the money because what was lost was yours. So Bishamai say that if you even plan on using it without permission, boom, that's it. Because the thought is, of course, what leads. The thought is the root that leads and sprouts into the action, and therefore we view you as if you already sinned and took control. These are all very, very good. We're going to skip a lot now to 11. Or maybe we'll just skip to the end. The kids, we get the point, right? Do we get the point? We get the point. Again, we can go on forever until we run a Malchoka says, but they seem to all be systematically based on this idea that that which could be, for example, this is a good one, I like this one on 12. When you take Truma and Maaser, so if you have olives and olive oil, or grapes and wine. So Basilel say those are considered two different species. So just like I can't take truma from apples to oranges, I can't take truma from olives to olive oil. Two different species. Right? There's a fruit and this is, you know, a liquid. And Bishamai say you can, because what are olives but potential oil? Meaning that which olives and grapes are traditionally used for oil and for wine to the extent that they get a special bracha because they're not considered waste like orange juice was considered in the old days. So olives and grapes are included within the potential to become this other thing, and the change doesn't matter because it didn't change. There's no change because it initially was also all an olive is solid olive oil. Said Uncle Ben. According to Beis Shammai, since an olive has the potential and will most likely be used to create olive oil, an olive is olive oil. It's one species. You get the point. And now, this brings us all to... this is one of my favorites. I made this up, but I really like it. No, really. I think it's... Again. In number 20... I like this. Number 20, we're talking about measuring a box. Why would you want to measure a box? So the halacha is that if a storage unit is big enough to be considered a... If a storing unit is big enough to be considered an ohel, a tent, a house, then it has different halachos regarding tuma. So a box will have different standard, different status in terms of tuma and tahara as opposed to a large, you know... trailer. So at which point does it become, once it holds 40 se'ah, size of the minimal size of a mikveh, so once a container is the size that it can contain 40 se'ah, then it stops being a vessel and starts being a house. A small house, right? Like mine. So how do you measure a box? There are two ways to measure a box. You can measure it from the outside or from the inside, because there's a certain ththickness to the walls of the box. So Beit Shammai Hashida is a cabinet. So Beit Shammai say we measure it from the inside. And it has to have the internal capacity to contain 40 se'ah to be considered a ohel as opposed to a kli. And basically, you measure it from the outside. And again, this is totally me making it up, but I think it works. That if I ask what the function of a box is in terms of its usability, what it can be used for, it's the inside that counts, right? If I have a box that is not like a pomela box, right? That it's 90% walls and only 10% box, Bishamai would say, in terms of what it can be used for, it's tiny. And Basil say, box is a box. We accept it, warts and all, walls and all, pomela skin and all. I don't know. Take it or leave it. Take it. Now, how does this... Oh, more. Yes. If we go into Chumras now in Dalet, we don't need the source. What would lead someone to make a gezeira? What leads you to say that A is forbidden midirabanan because it might lead to B, which is daraisa? It's so obvious now. It's not that Beit Shammai were afraid of being makel, they were nervous. It's that they viewed every action that is neutral, that has the potential to call something bad, as already bad. So doing action A, which in and of itself is normal and neutral and fine, but it has the power to lead you to B, is already a potentially bad action. So this is very nice that it's not just that, you know, we see some poskim that are always machmer, we wonder why. And it's a bit of a cheeky question to ask, you know, certain poskim, if you summarize the Hilchos Shabbos notes in most classes and you make a chart of, I'm not going to say names, of Rabbi A and Rabbi B, you'll pretty much see a consistent Mekel Machmer pattern. And is it chutzpah to say that, you know, I don't know, one of them, exactly. So, but what would lead you to make a decree is saying that A has in it the potential to lead to B, and B is bad, so A is bad by extension. So it's really nice and it makes perfect sense. In terms of Psak, two comments. One is, why do we pass like this Hillel? Well, Baskol. But the Gemara says something else. The Gemara, first of all, Beis Hillel with a majority and Beis Shammai with a minority, that already says something. Very few people in the world can live up to this standard of existence where you hold yourself to the actualization of your potential here and now, and you don't give yourself that leeway that I'm not perfect now, but I'm working on it slowly and I'll never get there most likely. But so Beis Shammai with a minority by definition, because not many people can be like that. But more than that, the Gemara says something really weird. And hey, not numbered. Both of them are true. Ignoring the fact that the majority in Adabaskol seems to be another reason why the halacha was formed like Beis Hillel. They were nochim ve'aluvim, which is that they were easygoing. And aluv in modern Hebrew means pathetic. I doubt that it means that. But they were easygoing and, you know, they were okay. They were tolerant of other people. Veshonim divrehem v'divrei Beit Shammai. Beit Shammai would teach their students their opinion. Beis Hillel would teach their students both opinions. And not just both opinions, they would teach Beit Shammai's opinion first. Now, why is this personality trait, which seems to be a bit pushoverish, why would there be reason to pass one like you? There should be a reason to not pass them like you. But I think the pshat is, the Maharal says this, that it's not that we pass them like them because the personality trait shows that they're more in tune with what mankind is capable of, and since God created mankind in such a way that they are very early on in the development towards perfection, that makes sense that the halacha should be adapted and relevant to them. It wouldn't be likely that God wanted the halacha to be something which only a few people can keep. Very elitist halacha. So I think that's the idea. And the flipping to Beis Shammai and Moshe Mashiach, the source for that is non-existent. The earliest source that I found for this is this piece. I mean, it's existent. What I'm saying, it's often referred to as Chazal say, right? Well, we don't know where something is. What do you say? It's in a Midrash. Midrash, synonym for I don't know, but I think it's in Chazal. So this is the earliest source I found for this, is about 300 years ago, from a sefer called Mikdash Melech by a Kabbalist. Kabbalist, and interesting, went from Morocco to London. So, you know, there is hope. You hear what? So, in this piece, which we will not read together, this is the earliest documented piece that I know of where someone quotes the Ari. Everyone points to the Ari. Maybe Ari is also like the Kabbalistic version of a Midrash. You know, if you don't know, you assume that it's second wave Kabbalah, so it's from the Ari. So, this is the first source that I know of that says that the halacha will flip in Moshe Mashiach. Now, what would lead you to say that? Why would halacha flip? And why from all of the machlokases do we find the dafka, the flipping, and say it makes sense in this world, pre-Mashiach, in the world of darkness and concealment, we're not able to live up to our potential. We have our Yetzirah, we have different versions of limitations, but we all agree that the ideal would be to live up to some sort of Beit Shammayan version of reality, to keep up the standards as high as possible. When Mashiach comes, and we have that ability, that should be the new level of expectation, and we should be able to live up to it. So this really explains everything. It's quite rare that one thing explains everything. Now, how does it connect to Tu Bishvat? Why is Rav Beis Shammai, in Beis Shammai's kindergarten, why were they singing Aleph Shvat Yigia Chag Leilanot? So think about it. What's the difference between Aleph and Tedvav? And don't say 14. What's the difference between... The difference is that the new moon is on Aleph, and the full moon is on Tedvav. Meaning to say that if I ask you when a month is, then Beis Shammai would say, well, the moment the moon appears, it's called a molad. When the moon is born, the whole month is encapsulated in that starting point. So if you wanted to grab the month by the horns, then you would say, Aleph, now I have a month. Ah, but it takes 14 days for me to fully see. Doesn't matter. it's all encapsulated in that starting point. The seed is where things are. And Basila is saying, no, if you ask me when I see the month, when does the month peak, where is the intent? It's in the middle, when the moon is at its fullest. So they all agree that Shvat is the month of Shvat, meaning Shvat is the month of the transition between last year and next year in terms of trees, but where to identify? I doubt that they argue on a agriculture, botanic level, when does the exact transition take place in seasons. You can't pinpoint anything seasonal with the Hebrew date. It doesn't work, because the dates shift, which is not now. But clearly it's more symbolic. It happens around Shvat in most years. Let's grab the month by the point that represents it most. And with this, this leads me to realizing that we have little time left in this class. But I'll mention one more thing. We see from creation, on many different levels, that Basila probably had it right. That God set out for himself, so to speak, a certain very high standard of things, but then, quote-unquote, changed his mind. It's one of the weirdest things that we have in Chazal, but in at least four places, Chazal talk about how Hashem wanted to do A, and then he did B. It seems a bit clear to say that Hashem is flippity-floppity, and he has plan A and plan B. Meaning, what are the examples? So we all know the split between Bereishis Aleph and Bet. In Aleph, everything is Elohim, in Bet is Hashem, and Chazal say that God wanted to create the world in Midas Hadin, where everyone would be judged in accordance to the high standard. He saw, whatever that means, he understood that the world would not be able to exist, and therefore he created the world in Midas Harachamim. Hashem wanted to create the world in Nisan, then he created it in Tishrei, right? There's another two. One is that it says that this seems to be more than he thought, that God created man and woman as one physical entity, back to back, and then he sawed them in half. That's the wording that is used. This is why there's not much going on in the back. Anyway, whatever. And then there's another one which is even weirder, which is when Hashem says that Vatotze Aretz Etz Pri Oseh Pri, Hashem said that there should be fruit trees that produce fruit, and then what the land did is Etz Oseh Pri, the trees that produce fruit. So Rashi brings it, that God wanted, he commanded earth to produce trees that taste like fruit. They produce fruit, so if you take a bite out of the tree, you taste apple. And the world, the earth, rebelled and produced tasteless trees that produce fruit. So what's pshat in all these things? So the pshat is that when it says God wanted to do A, it doesn't mean that he really wanted to do A. It means that that's what he wants the end goal to be. The end result, the ideal towards which we should strive, and the way things should be on a philosophical level, is perfect. But then there'll be no point to create a world. You're creating a world when everyone's already at the end of the game. And the whole point of creation is to create a tension between what is and what should be, what is and what ought to be. So the world in an ideal situation should be, according to Midas Hadin, we should fear and recognize and feel and experience God's presence to the extent that it's impossible for us to sin. But that's pointless. So I put you back a few steps in the starting point, and then I have to evoke Midas Harachamim to be forgiving. The world was supposed to be created in Nisan. Nisan is the Rosh Hashanah of Israel, right? The Bnei Israel, right? We call Rosh Hashanah for the regalim. But that's because Pesach is when we were created as a nation. So the end goal of creation is to have a nation that recognizes and is devoted to Avodas Hashem. But in the end, the world is created in the end. The proper beginning point is Tishrei, which is the physical creation of the world. So the point is that the world is created in this kind of raw state, and the end goal is to get to the fulfillment of the ideas that we were given afterwards in Matan Torah. It's the Maaseh Bereishis versus Matan Torah, elements of Shabbos. Man and woman were supposed to be, slash, maybe even were created as one entity. There's supposed to be perfect unity. But it needs to be worked towards. We start off as two different entities, and we have to spend our whole lives trying to get back to that ideological point where we are, ideal point, we are one thing. And the fruit in the tree is very nice, because that really finishes it off. The tree is that which produces the fruit. The tree has within it the power, the potential to produce fruit. But the tree doesn't taste like the fruit. The tree tastes like a tree, I imagine. But the point is that in principle, since the tree produces fruit, and the only way to get the fruit is by going through the tree, then the tree should also be a fruit. Because that which has the potential and produces B, A, should already be on the, in the Bechamai world, which is the world that God, so to speak, wanted to create, meaning the ideal towards we're striving, is that all kol ma'aseh hayu shem shamayim, even those things which are just neutral, they should be stepping stones towards things that are more spiritual. But we don't exist in that world. We don't say L'shem Yichud before we, you know, have a hamburger, and somehow that intensifies Avodas Hashem. No, it makes you go to sleep and, you know, miss Mincha. So that's the world we live in. And I'll just end with one thing, which is that on Rosh Chodesh Shvat, the moon is there, and it's full. It's just that we don't see it. Meaning, it's not that the moon grows, right? We talk about that the moon. The moon doesn't grow from Aleph to Yudaleh. The moon's always there, just concealed. And I think that's the way to view potential, which is, it's so hard and scary when people talk about actualizing your potential. But if you realize, by definition, the word potential isn't necessarily acquiring new skills. When you acquire new skills, then you generate a new potential, which is why it's constant. So, of course, B'Chama, you're right, that we have very, very strong ideals. If you don't paint a target, you won't get very far. Or you'll get very far in the wrong direction. You can get very far without a target, without a goal, but in the wrong way. So, of course, B'Chama, you're right, that there is an end goal, and all of our life should be dedicated towards reaching it. But we were created in the Basilel world, where we know that we start off quite nebuch, and we have to take baby steps one by one to start getting... And it's important to keep that in mind, because very often when we fail, we give up. The pasuk says Sheva Yipol Tzadik V'Kam, and there's a pshat and there's a chassidish vort, which by definition means something which isn't pshat, but it's a great idea. I think that's the dictionary definition. So the pasuk means that seven times, which is just a symbol of the natural multiplicity, seven times the tzadik falls and he still gets up. That's the sign of failing, but still. But the chassidish vort is Sheva Yipol Tzadik V'Kam, meaning, and with that experience, he uses it to get up. So it's important to remember that we do live in a Basilel world, which means that we will fall and we will fail, but as long as we plan, we do have the chance to somehow living up to our potential. Shkoyach, everyone. Ah, you're welcome.
Ask the question.
No.